Hey guys, I'm Matt and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Matt.
My sobriety is April 13th of 2015. I have a sponsor who I talk to every day, and my home group is the Midtown Group. We meet at Walter Johnson High School at 7:30 in Bethesda, Maryland, if you're ever out in that area. You know, we welcome you guys to join us. Thank you guys so much for asking me to come speak. It's a privilege and an honor to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I absolutely did not think that when I first got here. But before I go into my initial opinion of AA, you know, I'll talk in a general way of what I was like, what happened to me, and what I'm like today. I grew up in a divorced family. So all my life, you know, going back and forth between my mom and my dad's house, and I was a troublemaker from day one. My parents had me seeing therapists by the time I was like 8 years old. And the theme of my childhood was, you know, what's wrong with Matt? And I didn't know I was different than other kids. Cause who psychoanalyzes themselves at, you know, age 10 or 11. What I did know was that, I felt off. Something felt off. And, I didn't know what it was until I drank for the first time. I was getting in trouble at school. I would just impulsively do really stupid bad things. I would lie all the time. I'd create these fantasy worlds that I'd just think about and try to live in. Anything for me to not be here now. Anything for me so I wouldn't have to think about who I was. Because I didn't think I liked myself very much. And the first couple of things that you know, got me out of myself were reading, then it was video games, and then it was girls, and then once I got to middle school, I started hearing about drugs and alcohol, and I was fascinated with this idea that something could make me feel different, make me feel better. And the kids, you know, I'm probably 13 at the time, like, a lot of kids when they're 13, they're thinking about, you know, getting their homework done, maybe extracurriculars like you know, sports or doing something with their family. And I was on a completely different track. And I started, like, the music taste that, you know, I had changed, you know, and I started gravitating towards a certain type of crowd. And I just became obsessed with this idea of making myself feel different. And I started doing you know, drinking and doing drugs, and you know, my first couple of times drinking were very, very abnormal. And it's only in retrospect that I can identify the allergy of the body, which is, a you know, one of the dual parts that are core to my alcoholism, and really what can kill me if I drink again. I was in Denmark with a family friend, and there was some family party going on, and I guess I had like some mojito or something like that, something with liquor in it. And the parents like sent me off to this other room. And this girl was just sort of sipping her mojito next to me. And I just started begging her. I was like, please, can I have it? Like, please, can I have it? And, I didn't think anything then. She just probably thought I was weird. But it wasn't until AA where I like got the language and vocabulary to describe the experiences I had that I can now identify this as the phenomenon of craving. And that's just that is a minor that's a minor sort of example of what was to come. I started, you know, skipping class. I almost didn't graduate middle school, which I think is a pretty big accomplishment to almost not graduate middle school, because I think you just got to show up at that age. And I was, because my parents were divorced, I was faced with the decision of which high school I got to go to, because, you know, two different neighborhoods. And, you know, I'd been getting messed up at this point. I had realized that, you know, drinking and doing drugs, made me feel okay. And, a note about that, I feel like I can, in one of a strong member of my home group, describes it this way too, is, you know, I can draw a line between before I got messed up for the first time and after. It was such an impactful moment in my life, such a, like, a pivotal moment in all the decisions I was to make afterward. That I can see it so distinctly in my own life. And that's because I had never really enjoyed true peace and ease in myself until I had gotten messed up for the first time. So I let my shoulders drop and I said, I'm going to be okay. And once I had gotten that feeling, I was going to do anything I could to feel it as much as possible whenever possible. And my friends at the time, because we were young, they were kind of worried about me. They were, you know, they were asking me things like, how often are you going to do this? And I'd say things out like every 3 weeks, and then the next day I'd be doing it again. And I didn't think anything of it because I wasn't experiencing consequences at the time. But I ended up choosing to go to high school in my dad's neighborhood because it had more money, and I thought with more money comes more drugs, more alcohol, more parties. So at a very young age, I'm making not huge decisions, but relatively important decisions about where my life is going, completely based on access to drugs and alcohol, completely based on it, completely based on how am I going to feel okay. And what I would later find out is that when I make decisions completely on how is Matt going to be okay, when I completely make decisions on self-will rather than making decisions on how can I better my fellow man next to me, I ended up ruining my life. And I go to this high school, and I want to find the kids that party, so of course I joined the football team. And soon after finding the kids that party on the football team, I'm faking injuries and getting messed up with the managers of the football team, and I'm getting messed up before school. And I went into high school with goals, because I have amazing, amazing, loving parents who did their best to try to instill values in me, instill a sense of work ethic in me, and really valued education. And it's not their fault, you know. I'd found the only thing that ever made me feel okay. And the feeling of getting an A on a paper compared to, being drunk and completely okay in your own skin, it's like, you know, it's apples to oranges, you know. And I quickly started to put aside all things that I was, you know, what was supposed to be important to me. My mom's opinion of me, my dad's opinion of me. I have a little brother who looks up to me dearly, and all those things started to go out the window, and I wasn't really thinking anything of it. And there's a lot of people in AA who say, you know, alcohol took things from me, and I'm of the belief that I gave things away for alcohol. I decided to give away the relationship with my mom for the relief that alcohol gave me. And while I didn't have a choice once I started drinking, I was, you know, because I'm consumed by alcoholism, it is a, alcoholism just doesn't really care about who cares about me. And that's just, you know, the truth of my existence and the truth of my life until, you know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm drinking and I'm doing drugs whenever I can. I'm getting messed up before school. School administration is starting to, like, see that I'm coming across the street in school a little bit late sometimes. Sometimes I'm smelling a little weird. And one day, a school administrator comes into my class and, asks for another student. And I'm acting super goody. Cause once in a school administrator, cause I know how to talk to different groups of people. You know, I'm able to fit in wherever I need to fit in. And then as an adult talking to me, I can be, you know, straight laced and super polite, you know, say my yes sir, or my yes ma'ams, and I'm okay. And, she ended up looking for me, and she pulled me out in the hallway and started, bringing up some activities that she thought I was doing. And, brought me down to the principal's office, and this really scary administrator came in, and, they asked me about what I was up to, and why I was coming to school messed up. And, I just started this sob story talking. I blamed it on my dad, and we don't have a good relationship. And, I'm a new student here. I just moved here, all this stuff. And they let me go and search my bag, thank God. And I told myself, all right, I'm never getting messed up before school or at school ever again. And then the next week I found myself drinking, you know, before school, or drinking in class, my first period class, or doing drugs before school, or doing drugs at lunch. And that's another thing about alcoholism is this, like, it doesn't matter what, like, goals or lines or parameters around my life I try to set, I will pass them all. You know, it's like I have a complete disregard for where I actually want to go in life. Completely, there's no love of self when I'm drinking, none at all. It's my life is bent on self-destruction when I'm drinking. And I'm making decisions like this left and right. Drugs sort of stop working for me at this point, what I was doing, and alcohol seems to be the only thing that really makes me black out. And so, because I'm like not going to school completely blacked out on the weekends, I'm finding a place to stay for, I have like a huge span of hours so that I can just get obliterated as possible. Because I was never really a social drinker. You know, I never was looking for a buzz or anything like that. Like, I wanted to be absolutely obliterated. Like, that's where relief was for me. It was like, I didn't even want to know I existed, you know, but I wanted to feel the pleasure of drinking. And I'm doing this all the time. I become the manager of the basketball team, so my parents will stop asking me where I'm going after school, but this is just another excuse to get messed up after school and do this. My values and how I'm treating other human beings goes right out the window. I have no capacity to be kind unless you have something that I want. My friends are picked completely on the basis of whether they have access to alcohol and drugs and if they have money. And I become this, you know, unwanted hanger-on, as it talks about in the book. And, I was definitely hanging out with some, you know, fellows in spots lower than me, but I think it could be easily said that while my mom probably thought, you know, if only he stopped hanging out with those people, or if only he wasn't around that crowd, he'd be fine. She did not understand that no matter where I would go in life, no matter what place you put me, whether it be Alaska or Hawaii, I was going to find the people who were doing what I was doing because I needed relief. That's something else about alcoholism that people don't understand. They think that, if I just change my physical environment, things are going to be okay. And I had to realize in AA that it didn't matter where I go. If I didn't fix what was going on in here, if I didn't connect to something greater than myself, no matter where I went, I was going to be screwed. I'm living this way of life, and things are stopping working. I'm not getting the effects that I once did, and eventually sort of culminated to having a party at my house. Standard high school drinking story. Got some seniors to buy me some booze, stash it in the woods, and parents leave the house, and, you know, I invite people over, and I actually told myself I wasn't going to drink that night, you know, as I had done, you know, before, where I set these lines of why I shouldn't be drinking. And, you know, another part of this alcoholism, along with the phenomenon of craving, is this peculiar mental twist that happens within me. And that if even though I have evidence on evidence on evidence backing on why I should not be drinking tonight or why I shouldn't be drinking at 10 a.m., you know, something happens where it says, as long as I get this relief, it's going to be fine. Or maybe I don't really think at all and I just do it, you know. And I think you'll find that, you know, when I've worked with some new guys, sometimes it's pointless to ask why, you know, because we know why, you know, and that's also the amazing thing about Alcoholics Anonymous, which is like, this is the first place where people stopped asking why, you know, and they just showed me how I could live a different way of life. So I have, you know, I have these people over, and I told myself I wasn't going to drink that night, and I remember distinctly putting this like plastic handle of vodka on the table and like seeing the light go through the bottle and watch it swirl around. And I really thought this was magic. I really thought that anything that was going to change my state of mind was magic. And I started drinking. You know, all those ideas of why I shouldn't be drinking, why my parents were coming home in a couple hours, and how I should probably watch the party, make sure they don't trash my house. Why I shouldn't be doing what I'm doing. It all went out the window, and I started drinking. And phenomenon of craving, I can't stop. It's like I go on autopilot, and my alcoholism has no care for my physical well-being whatsoever. So I'm drinking beer after beer. I'm grabbing plastic bottles of liquor. I'm grabbing the handle of vodka and swigging it from the bottle. And all this is going on. My little brother's there, and he's watching me. And next thing I know, I'm falling backwards over a couch, and someone's looking down at me. And the next thing I know, I'm coming to in a hospital with an IV in my hand, because I'd ripped them out of both my arms. And what had transpired in that blackout was I drank so much I couldn't walk. My little brother, who's probably 11 or 12 at the time, helped carry me up 3 flights of stairs. And I slid back down on my head, and he helped me carry back up. I threw up, and my little brother, this kid who I'm supposed to be a role model to, who I'm supposed to help guide to show what a man of values is supposed to be, is cleaning up my throw up, and he helps me crawl into my room, and I can clothe myself, I pee myself, you know, all in front of my little brother, and he puts me to bed. Later, some girls come up to check on me to make sure I'm on my side and I'm okay. so I don't drown in my own throw up. And hours pass, no one thinks anything of me, and the house gets cleaned up, and my parents come home. My dad was in bed trying to go to sleep, and he hears what he thought sounded like furniture being moved around. So he comes up to check on me. I don't know what time it is, and he finds me foaming at the mouth with my eyes in the back of my head convulsing on the ground. He runs to go wake up my little sister and asks her, like, what did I take? He thought I'd taken hallucinogens, but really what had happened was a 14-year-old kid who could not feel okay on his own drank to oblivion. And alcoholism doesn't care how old you are, what circumstances you come from. The only thing alcoholism cares about is killing me, you know, and trying to trick me in any way it can to do that. So like I said, I came to in the hospital. Someone came into the hospital room and asked me if I had tried to kill myself, and I said no, because the truth of the matter was I was just trying to feel okay. And if you would have asked me at the beginning of that night if my plan was to end up in a hospital room with my parents surrounding me, looking down at me, scared that their child was going to die, of course I would have said no. I would have said I'm just trying to have fun, I'm just trying to party. You know, that would have been my response. Because I'm an alcoholic, when I drink, and because I have an abnormal relationship with alcohol, I am like a tornado going through the lives of other people. I just wreck anyone close to me. And I came to, and I'm bawling, crying, saying I grew up too fast. I'm hooked up to IVs. I'm hearing this heart monitor machine. I'm still like twice, you know, the legal limit in terms of drinking. I don't know. I don't remember what I blew, but it was really high. And I almost died. My mom got a call from my father in the hospital. My mom was in Delaware at the time. It was snowing in December. And she got a call from my dad saying that I might be put on life support. My mom told me later when I got some time, she told me that she ran to the toilet and started dry heaving. That's the kind of drinker I was. That's the cool, like, young, like, party kid I was. I make my mom so scared that her kid's going to die that she ends up dry heaving in the toilet. There's nothing glamorous or cool about who I was when I was drinking. It was completely selfish and just trying to make myself feel okay. And what I found is once I've gotten sober, my mind does a really good job at playing the highlight reel, trying to tell me, you know, if I drink again, this is what it's going to look like. When in all reality, I completely forget what I was actually like. And yes, there were good times. I had a lot of good times drinking, of course. But towards the end, it was not fun anymore. I was drinking to feel okay. Because I was hospitalized, they recommended that I go to outpatient rehab, which I was not a fan of. There were these professionals talking to me about something I felt like they had no idea about. I'm taking piss tests, and I'm in these groups where no one wants to be there, you know, and no one wants to talk about anything. I feel like these people are talking at me. But the best thing, I think the two things that outpatient rehab did for me was, one, it made me realize that, like, okay, like, not everyone is going to outpatient rehab. There might be something going on. You know, that was the first thing. The second thing was that it gave me a slip that I had to get signed at AA meetings. And it was sort of the catalyst to get me towards my solution, or what would become my solution. I started going to these meetings, and my dad and my mom, who are both in recovery, and helped raise my bottom so I didn't have to go as low as I could have gone. My dad took me to a meeting called Midtown, which is now my home group. And I heard a man speak who was to become my sponsor and say for the first time how I'd been feeling my whole life. He put words to feelings I didn't know existed. And no longer weren't asking why. They didn't ask, well, why did you drink knowing that you were going to mess up your life again? Like, I wasn't getting grilled like that anymore. It was, I understand what you did. I did that too. This is what I do now, and I'm okay. And that was something I had never heard of before. I'd inspected all sorts of religions, philosophies, and outlets that I thought would make me feel okay. And I found it wanting, most likely because I wasn't doing what those things were asking me to do. I would just think about it, which is another thing in AA. Like, you're not going to get anywhere if you think about this stuff. This is entirely a program of action and implementation into my daily life. So I hunted down this guy who spoke, and I asked him to be my sponsor. And I was so scared. And if you're new here tonight, or if you're new to recovery, and you're scared and you feel like this isn't working and your head's still going 100 miles an hour every day, you're waking up scared that you're going to get struck drunk or you're going to drink that day, or you don't want to come to these, you know, these stupid meetings with these weird people and their weird sayings, I understand, you know. But I think the worse you feel when you get in, the better, honestly, because it is a small window of opportunity when I came in. That if I felt a little bit better, if I had any notion of I got this, I wouldn't be speaking here tonight, I don't think. I had to be completely demolished by alcohol to realize that this is the last house on the block for me. And I didn't think I was an alcoholic when I first got in. I just thought, you know, I'm just a pothead who got in too much trouble. And as my sponsor took me through the book and started to help me look at my relationship with alcohol, I started to realize that it matched just, like, you know, to the T. With all these stories and the doctor's opinion and all these things. He started showing me how to live a different way of life. And in the reading before I spoke, we talked about it talked about how each man meets God in its own way here. And I think how initially I met my higher power was through action and self-sacrifice and service to other people. Because I was really questioning about any sort of religion or higher power or anything like that, I was sort of tricked into believing in something greater than myself, because I could not deny that when I put my will aside and decided to just go to the meeting anyways, I felt a little bit better after. And I could not deny that when I was of service at home and helpful to my family, I felt a little bit better. And I also could not deny that when I talked to someone with less time than me or someone who was just going through it, I felt a little bit better. And what I know now to be my own truth is that, you know, for me to have contact with my higher power, I have to do actions that I think, it would have me do. And for me, that is love and service to other human beings. And, I started doing these steps. I did, my first four step, I was walking into, with my sponsor to his car to read it. Off to him to do a fifth step, and I'm reading the names, and I get to the third column. I finish the third column for the name, and I go to the next name. He's like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa! Where's your fourth column?" I was like, "Fourth column." He's like, "Yeah, your part." And I was like, "I didn't see that in the thing. I didn't know I have to do my part." And he was like, "You have to write this whole thing over again because I had written an entire four step with no notion of where I was responsible for anything, which is the entire point of it." But my sponsor really, this is a serious thing. I take sponsorship very seriously, and my sponsor takes sponsorship very seriously, because I am entrusting my life in a lot of my life decisions with the guidance of another man. My first sponsor really cared about me. He loved me dearly, and I started doing what he suggested, and my life started to change. I can still remember the first time I was in the car with my father. He told me he was proud of me, and it was the first time in my entire life where I felt like I actually deserved it. I went from getting messed up under bridges to becoming my class president, and these are all things that I never, like, you know, things that I would think about, you know, when I was at home alone, you know, goals and things I wanted to do in life, but never something that I ever took action on. And the person I was started to change. People started to give me qualities to myself that I'd never heard before, give me attributes about myself that I'd never heard before, that, you know, I show up, I'm kind, that I'm considerate, and that when I ask people how they're doing, it feels like I really mean it, all things I'd never heard before. And people noticed a change in me before I did. But what I could not stop obsessing about was that other people got to drink and I could not. I was obsessed with this idea that why me? Because a lot of people I got messed up with drank in a similar fashion to I did. We all got messed up pretty bad, and I was like, what? I feel like I'm the one on the hook. Like, this is not fair, you know. And I didn't hear this till years later, but something that really helped me with this feeling of like, why me? Someone in a meeting said, if not you, who? Like, why do I think I am so special that I get to avoid just living a human existence. Like, why do I get to think that I don't have to suffer as every other human being on this earth suffers? With just life things. And my thing just happens to be alcohol. I remember one time I was in the car with my sponsor, my current sponsor, and I was complaining. I was, you know, probably talking about how I couldn't go be around pretty girls and beer cans at a party. And he said, do you wanna drive to Children's National? I was like, what is he talking about? Why would we go to the Children's Hospital? And he's like, I want you to go to one of the hospital rooms to a family with a kid who has cancer. And I want you to tell them that you're really upset that every night of the week you have to go see your friends, get out of yourself and help other human beings, and be of service to something greater than yourself. And as like, that's the hardest thing in your life. And I was like, oh. You know, like as bad as sometimes I think it is to be an alcoholic or have to do these things that are uncomfortable, this life is a blessed one for me. Like I am gifted beyond recognition, and it often takes other people's prompting and pointing out for me to realize that I'm okay and it's really not that bad. But I couldn't realize that all the time, and because I became obsessed with this idea of wanting to be like other people, as it talks about in page 30 and more about alcoholism, I slowly started backing myself out of AA. I started acting how I wanted to act, and when I act when I'm a dry drunk, I get uncomfortable, and if my feet aren't planted in AA, I will instantly go back to what I know will make me feel comfortable, and that's drugs and alcohol, you know, no matter what. That's what I did. I marched like 5 miles or something like maybe like 3 miles through like deep snow to go get messed up with people I hadn't seen in years. And it was super uncomfortable. It was like, hey, how are you? I haven't seen you forever. Like, let's go get messed up. You know what I mean? And they're like, whoa, like that is not how like normal human relationships, like start off when you haven't seen someone in a while. Usually it's like, sit down and tell me what's been going on, you know? And, I get messed up and I pick up right where I left off. Like, you know, it was just like the obsession was back on, you know, in those periods of sobriety between getting messed up, it was all I thought about. And when I got messed up, I was seeking oblivion. And when I initially relapsed, I was trying really, really hard to control it. And I did I had several instances where, I drank a little bit and I stopped. And then I was like, all right, I did it. I stopped. Now we're good to go. Green light, you know, and then it was oblivion again, you know. It was never something I could do on a consistent basis, because drinking moderately for me is like getting bit by a mosquito and not being able to scratch the bite. Like, that's honestly how I feel about it. I hate it. I would actually rather not drink than drink a little bit and stop. It is aggravating to me. And it seems unnatural, and I don't understand how people do it. Even in movies, when I watch movies, I see people leave glasses of wine on the table. I'm like, geez, come on, man. You know, I notice it, you know, and it's so weird. It's how I know my brain doesn't work normally. And I'm getting messed up, and I'm with the same people in the same basements doing the same thing all over again. And I'm seeing my relationship slowly slip away. All that work, all that step work, and all those things, that guy that I tried to become, a man of values and worth and service to others, gone in a snap. I instantly became the lying and manipulative guy I was before. Because that, like, on my own, without a program and a set of actions and guiding principles, like we have over here, to my own accord, I lie, I cheat. I steal, and I use people to get what I want, and I'm drinking with this like just ferocity that I hadn't before, because I think I had lost the delusion that I was doing this for fun. By the time I had relapsed, I realized that I was simply drinking for relief, and I could no longer tell myself that this narrative of I'm just trying to have fun And this is something I'm supposed to be doing, because I had come to AA and I'd heard the truth. And I'm sure you guys have heard the saying of, like, you know, belly full of beer and a head full of AA. And I literally felt like I was drinking and reading the Big Book at the same time. I would like exhibit these behaviors, and I'm like, oh, I remember like hearing about that in a meeting, or I remember reading that. And it's awful. It is awful. My stomach felt like it was in a knot almost 24/7. Every morning I'm waking up thinking, like, am I going to get caught by the cops today? No longer was I starting my day off with prayer and meditation and trying to connect to something greater than myself and starting it with a sense of peace and ease. It was like, you know, my first thought of the morning was like, what do I need to do and who do I need to contact to get what I need to get messed up? And when I live my life that way, it's like very clear as to like what is the center of my attention. And my parents, who are in the program, like knew very quickly what was going on. I don't think they knew what to do. I remember this one instance where I was really trying to be good, and I was like, all right, Dad, like, let's watch a movie together, to try to like be a good son. And I start the movie off, and then I know that there are people like getting messed up during the day. And I got so restless. I was like, Dad, can you just drop me off at this house? You know, I can't even finish a movie with my father. You know, I have to feel the relief that alcohol gives me. And eventually my father, after a night where I'd drinking so much that morning I'd woken up shaking, with no ability to hold a glass of water and looking in the mirror just like I had years ago in the hospital, having no idea who I was. My father accused me of getting messed up again. He wanted to drug test me. And for whatever reason, I was exhausted. I was so tired of doing this thing. I was tired of looking at the clock to see how much I needed to drink or how much I needed to smoke to get messed up where I could feel relief but not get too messed up where I come home and get sent to some rehab in the middle of nowhere. I treated my body like a system, you know. And I just said, okay. Like, I just gave up. And as terrible of a situation that was, I got a sense of relief that I didn't have to fight anymore, that it was going to be okay. And I started going to meetings again, and I dropped my previous sponsor because I felt like he wasn't letting me do what I wanted to do, and I wanted someone a little bit more easy on me. And I, this time around, I was just like, you know what, if I'm going to do AA, I'm going to do it. And I'm going to pick someone who works a program and is deeply embedded in the steps and lives his life this way, and someone who's comfortable in their own skin. That was the main criteria, is like, are you comfortable in your own skin? Because I certainly wasn't. And I started working with this guy Eric, who's up in Midtown, and he took care of me, plain and simple. He'd pick me up from my house. I was still in high school at the time. I got sober initially when I was 15, and then again when I was 16. And my sponsor would come pick me up in front of the house. My father would walk out and hand my sponsor a $20 bill because my dad couldn't trust me with money that I wouldn't go out and buy drugs or beer. And my sponsor would take me to the mall before a meeting. We'd get dinner, and I'd just be crying in the car, just like, couldn't believe how my life got like this again, how I was so sure that I was going to be different this time when I was drinking, and completely just a mess. Little by little, I just let people take care of me here. I would go to meetings like five meetings a week now, because I now, you know, have dinner with my mom once a month or once a week, and then another night of the week I do something for school. Initially I was going to seven meetings a week and talking to multiple people throughout the day. I would wake up and, like, when I was new, like, the first thing I'd think of was drinking. You know, I was so terrified that I'd end up drinking that day. And so it really took a village for me to, like, take care of me. And that's what we do for each other here. Like, I don't know any of you, but if any of you guys had ever called me with something, I would go through hell and back to make sure you guys were okay. What that is I think we have a common understanding here, is that we have all been shipwrecked together. And now that we're meeting here, we have some sort of solution. We're in the lifeboat, and I'll do whatever I can to help you stay on, you know. And that's what people did for me. I started doing the steps with my sponsor. He had me read up to page 64 on my own and write down everything I related to, I didn't relate to, and anything I had questions on. I had a lot of questions. I like to think of myself as a pretty smart guy, and I really wanted to peg my sponsor with a bunch of questions, you know, really stick it to him to see if he couldn't answer any of them. And I'm pretty sure he answered all of them. And if he didn't, he owned it. That's another thing about my sponsor is my sponsor is someone who doesn't claim to know anything he doesn't know. He's a man who's humble and is real and is comfortable being that way, something I respect immensely. He started taking me through the book again, something about the big book is that if you reread it, or if you're in a big book meeting, you'll find things that you weren't there before. It's like, it's like when you close it, like little somethings, like come in there and sneak new words and phrases and stories that you had never related before. And that's why it sort of reminds me that this is a lifelong journey, that there's no graduating from AA. There's no diploma that any of us are going to get. It is a life of ever expanding, seeking to be better spiritually and just to be a better human being. For my second step, for my second and my third step, we sort of just went over the ABCs that it talks about, I think, after how it works. And my second step, coming to believe that a power greater than myself would restore me to sanity, has more actually happened in retrospect. It wasn't like something that happened right when I went over with him. It has been something where I've looked back and realized that that I haven't drank, which is insane for me to say. Like, my default existence is a sense of discomfort where I need something to make me feel okay. And the fact that I can look back and realize that because I've implemented this way of life, I'm comfortable in my own skin, makes me realize that there's some sense of sanity in my life. And it's easy to think that when we talk about sanity and insanity of the second step, it's easy to think of like psych wards or mental illness and something like that. But what the sanity and insanity that they're really talking about in the second step is the insanity that precedes the first drink, which I talked about briefly before, which is that situation where you know in your heart of hearts that this is the worst idea and this is probably playing Russian roulette with your life, but I drink anyways. You know, and what AA allows me to do is has a pause and gives me this connection to a power greater than myself that acts as a buffer between me and the alcohol that's around me. Because I can't avoid the fact that people are drinking. It's St. Patty's Day, you know, happy St. Patrick's Day, guys. It is just a fact, like, there is alcohol in this world. People are getting messed up. I'm in college, and thank God I don't live on campus, but people party, you know. Like, it is just, you know, at any stage of life, whether it be college, professional workplace, dinner parties, you know, whatever it may be, people drink. And if I don't have a connection to something greater than myself to buffer me from all of these situations that life provides, I'm screwed, you know. And it talks about in the big book how, you know, something like that, you can't even go to, like, Greenland or Iceland, you know, without maybe an Eskimo showing up with whiskey, you know. And there's truth to that, you know. And then for my third step, this is something that I'm struggling with today, because my life has gotten so, so good. And I tend to think that because my life has gotten so good materially, I suddenly think that I can call the shots. Like, hold on, Coop, you know, I got this one. Coop's my sponsor. You know, like, I don't need your input on everything. In fact, I think I can start making some big decisions for myself. I don't really need to run it by anyone, and that the words, you know, the thoughts going through my head are completely right, and I can live my life unchecked. I get really uncomfortable when I try to do everything on my own in life, and I completely have my life be one of seeking something to make myself feel good. Because what I found is that while it is totally appropriate and fine to do well materially, like, that is, like, that's just a fact. It's okay to do. It cannot be the sole end of my life. If I'm going to stay sober long term and live this way of life, the center of my life, and my thoughts and my activities need to be gravitated and orienting towards helping other people, because that's when I feel okay in my own skin. And I believe that my step three, turning my will and my life over to power greater than myself, consists of, like it talks about in the big book, giving much of my spare time to Alcoholics Anonymous and helping other alcoholics to achieve sobriety, and being open-minded enough to listen to the input from my sponsor. The great thing about sponsorship is that it is an objective viewpoint for my life. My sponsor is not emotionally attached to the decisions I make, but I am. I love to be able to make my own decisions. I care a lot about the things that go on in my life, and I'm often met with, "Have you helped anyone today?" When I'm telling my sponsor this very intense situation that I think is very pertinent to my life and whether or not I'm going to be okay. What I found from that is that there's just some feeling I get after talking to a new guy that everything's going to be okay, and I suddenly forget all the things I was worrying about before. And I can't put my finger on what that feeling is. I just know it works, so I keep doing it. The fourth step, I did a fourth step that was much more rigorous than the one previously. I had hundreds of names on my fourth step, and I did a thorough inventory because I was so terrified that if I wasn't thorough, I was going to drink again. I went through my entire life looking for any resentments. And I did a fifth step with my sponsor, and it took 10 and a half hours. We had to like separate it into different chunks. And I told that man things that I never told anyone else. Things that I was going to, probably die with. Things that if I thought about late at night would make my face red with embarrassment from some of the things I did. And not all of these actions were when I was drunk. Like, I am completely capable of harming other human beings and seeking what I want or trying to be the funny guy when I'm sober. Like, it is completely capable for me not to act right sober. Whether I'm in AA or before I even came to the program, I told my sponsor all these terrible things. My stomach felt sick after my fifth step. I didn't get any like white light experience. But what I did get was, an experience with my sponsor where he told me that he loved me and, that I wasn't the worst of the worst. I certainly wasn't the best of the best, and maybe I was somewhere in the middle. And what the fourth step and the fifth step aimed for me to do is to give me a realistic outlook on who I am and where my role is and what I need to do. But honestly, I think one of the most important things that came out of that was realizing that I know that there's another human being on this earth that knows everything about me and everything I've ever done to harm another human being. They still love me. And there's immense freedom in that. And even though I didn't get a sort of white light experience after my fifth step, in the weeks following, when I looked in the mirror, the guy looking back at me wasn't so bad. And I was okay. And it was going to be okay. And six and seven, even though it's very short in the big book, it's going to be a lifelong endeavor, working with defects of character. It's hard. It is so hard because a lot of the things that, a lot of these defects of character, like pride, for me, I can get really egotistical and like to show off or, act cocky. I get something out of it. Like, I wouldn't do it if I didn't get anything out of it. And it talks about, in the 12 and 12, how we're really scared of letting these defects go, and we're going to be there's going to be a hole in the donut, it talks about. It makes the analogy of the hole in the donut, because I think, like, if I don't act this way, like, who am I going to be? Like, I feel like AA is trying to make me some robot. You're not going to be a robot. You're still going to be you. In fact, this whole process of removing these defects from myself and clearing away all this muck is to open the present that's inside. Sandy Beach talks about that, how this process of the steps is a unraveling of who we really are. And it's not trying to make us a one whole group of people that everyone's like everyone else. In fact, it's trying to appreciate the, you know, the specialness of each individual here and what they can contribute to other people. And it's a beautiful thing, because when I first got here, I really thought that this was like a cult with weird prayers, weird sayings, and weird people, you know. And I thought they were just trying to make me think, you know, all the same way. And I definitely think it's good that I needed a change in thinking, for sure. But my opinion, I love AA now. With 7-step, I do that prayer pretty regularly, trying to turn these defects over. And if I'm not willing to turn them over, getting the willingness, you know, to be willing to turn them over. Because I really do enjoy a lot of the things that aren't good for me, you know. Whether it be like copious amounts of tobacco consumption or just seeking attention, you know, whatever it may be. My 8-step was much shorter than my 4-step. I got a little neurotic with my 4-step, and so there were names on there that probably didn't need to be on there. And I sort of went overzealous with it. And my 8-step was a pretty humbling process too. It was a sort of a list of, you know, names that where I'd done harm. And a lot of them, my sponsor said, I should not reach out. And, that there were people whose lives would be better off if I didn't send out, you know, saying, hey, you know, can we meet up or anything like that. The 9-step has been probably the most fundamental, you know, changing part of my life here in AA. I made amends to my little brother, you know, that kid who I talked about before, who carried me up those flights of stairs. And when I asked him if there's anything I can do to make it right, he said, just keep going to AA. That's all he wanted from me. My sister, who I scared, and I think I've caused some serious, like, trauma with that whole fiasco and me almost dying, we're so close. She calls me if she has boy troubles, and I give her advice. And I try to help her, guide her through her life in any way I can. You know, I had to make amends to a golf course that I did thousands of dollars worth of property damage to. And I was met with leniency and forgiveness. And a teacher who I just terrorized her classroom, I called and made amends to her, and came to understand that a lot of these people in these professional positions, these jobs, have families and have feelings. And it is not okay for me to treat other people as objects or, you know, beckoning servants of what I want, and that every human being deserves love and respect. 10-step is, that's probably the worst. I do not enjoy the 10-step because it's so uncomfortable. Because my 10-step amends is when I'm sober. That's when I'm, like, making messed up things, like, on the daily basis of, like, whether it be a comment, an action, not doing something I know I'm supposed to be doing that would probably help out my family. Just being selfish and having to own it, saying, hey, I messed up here. Like, what can I do to make it right? It is so uncomfortable. And there were times where my sponsor would tell me not to make amends because he knew I was going to do it again. He was like, let's just, like, have you change your behavior first before you start going to these people. The 11th step is super important to me. I make it a point every morning to pray and meditate and try to start my day with a contact with something greater than myself. And I end every day with thank you and in prayers. And something, a gift of the program, is my grandmother, who's also sober, she emails me every morning like a spiritual article or a poem that she enjoys and tells me what she's going to do for that day. And then I respond and tell her what I'm doing for my day. And that's been because my sponsor told me to start calling my grandparents once a week and check in to see how they're doing. None of my other family members do that. That's all because of these. None of these ideas are mine. And that's the thing that probably sucks about this the most, is that I'm getting all this credit and love for ideas and actions that I did not come up with on my own. And my 11th step has allowed me to walk more comfortably in the world, because when I got sober, my head really went at 100 miles an hour. Like, my friends can attest, I would constantly be reaching out to my friends Matt and Lee, just absolutely nuts, convinced I was going to drink, you know, if I had a thought of drinking, I was like, I'm going to die. I'm going to drink. It's going to happen. You know what I mean? And I had no ability to be calm and be okay in my own skin. But now I am consciously aware that there's something out there, and I don't know exactly what it is. I just know that it loves me and wants me to love other people, and I have to try my best to do that. And then, you know, finally, for the 12th step, I try to inconvenience myself to give other alcoholics what I've been given, a life of freedom, love, and care for myself and other human beings. I've had a spiritual experience, and I think it's more to come. I think it's of the educational variety, meaning it's happened gradually, and I think there's still so much more to go. But there's been a fundamental change in how I look at the world, how I look at myself, and what I need to do in it. So it's been an honor to come here and speak. Thank you for my sobriety, and thanks for letting me share.